Welcome to this latest episode of the Space Game Junkie Podcast. I, as always, am your co-host, Brian, and with me, as always, is our awesome co-host, Jim.
Hello.
And this week we have two guests, which is a real treat. First, from Matrix Games, we have Eric Ruttens? Ruttens? I'm sorry, I didn't ask how you said that.
It's okay, it's Ruttens.
Ruttens, okay. We have Eric Ruttens from Matrix Games. And from Code Force, we have Elliot Gibbs. Did I say that correctly?
You got that right.
Woo! So this week, we are all about distant worlds all the time. And I'm going to just tell you folks, I told the others before we started recording, I don't know if you've read my stuff on the blog, but I am all a gush. I am all a flutter because I love distant worlds so hardcore. So I'm just super excited to have both you, Eric, and you, Elliot, on the show to talk to you about this truly landmark game, I think, in the space game genre, because there really isn't anything else like it. I mean, you have these grand war games that do the war in the Pacific, and you have these grand, you know, like Europea Universalis, and these just grand strategy games, but you really don't have anything like that. I mean, you have like the Master of Orion, but nothing like this, you know? So I want to start at the beginning.
Thanks. It's our pleasure to be here.
It's again, the pleasure is all mine. So I want to start at the beginning. I want to find out where the inspiration for this came from, how you got started, how Codeforce and Matrix met up and pushed this thing out to the unsuspecting masses, of which I was one.
Well, my idea for Distant Worlds was pretty much just make a game that I wanted to play. And so I guess it was the idea of having a big, wide-open galaxy with lots of things to do and lots of activity. That was the real core of the idea, you know. And so it was actually a long time in development as just a bit of a hobby for me, and until I eventually realized that maybe other people might want to try this too. And so that's sort of when we got hold of Matrix and went from there, really. Our initial contact with Matrix, though, I've got to say, it was kind of funny. I think we got our wires crossed, and we didn't get any response back from them initially. So I emailed them a couple of times,
what?
And eventually I got to the right person. So it just about didn't happen at the start there. But eventually we got
very glad that turned out okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we got in touch with David and Eric, and away we went.
Mm-hmm. So help me with this analogy here. I have very limited exposure to the game, but I've watched some Let's Play videos, and I installed it today and was going through the tutorial and that. And initially, when I was hit with this fire hose of information that I'm trying to drink from, and then as the tutorial progressed, it started to make sense. And I started to think, like, wow, I wish that Dwarf Fortress had a tutorial in it like this, because I would maybe be able to penetrate that game.
Or even a manual,
Yeah, exactly. And because I got a buddy that's just all about Dwarf Fortress, right? From what he talks about it and the level of detail and information and just how things are, you can go in and micromanage about as much as you want, or you can just kind of let it automate, right? So I'm looking at like Rogue being the single point of like your single point of control, that one character. And then if you evolve Rogue forward into Dwarf Fortress, where there's just like all this minutia that's going on and so much information, and I don't know how anybody can actually take in what's going on, you know, without letting the AI manage a bunch of it. But I'll leave that for you to explain later. But that would be like if you took a Master of Orion kind of game and extrapolated it into like a Dwarf Fortress. That's kind of what I perceive this as doing.
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, that said, there's a lot of detail and a lot of things, you know, you can dig into if you want to. And, you know, that can be good. You know, a lot of people like that. But, of course, everyone has their own focus, the things that they like to play, you know, the part of the game they like to play best. And so, you know, we started off and wrote all this detail in there. And actually, it was what you see now is actually in some ways a simplified form of what we started off with. We realized it was just too crazy detailed and cut some stuff out. But then, of course, we realized we really needed some sort of automation system where you could choose what to play and what not to play. So that sort of was actually something that gradually got pushed into the game with our early testing. That was some of the initial feedback, unsurprisingly, that it was in some ways a bit too complicated.
Yeah, I could see that, because I gotta say one thing that I don't know where you guys came up with this. I want to ask you, because when I was reading the manual after revisiting the game with Legends, you mentioned that try a game with one ship, just automate everything except for one ship and try it that way. So I did, and that was an amazing way to really get into the game for me. Like after a few hours of that, everything just clicked, and it's just been a love fest ever since. But one, how did you come up with that particular idea, just to do the one ship thing, because it's brilliant? And two, are there any other little things like that you can do in the game with the automation?
Well, I guess it's from the developer's perspective, knowing what's involved, what the ships are actually doing, and the level of detail there. I guess you want people to see that and help them to learn how the game works, I suppose. When you do that, you can sort of see a little bit about what's going on in this little corner of the galaxy. So I guess that was my motive for recommending that you can get a feel for the mechanics of it and what the ships are all doing. And I guess it helps you appreciate that that's happening all over the galaxy, you know, and I think that is a lot more immersive then.
How does the player become aware of everything that's going on? Is there like a news ticker that keeps you informed of events that are going on? Because I noticed the game, it seems to play out in real time, but you can pause to inspect things and give orders, right?
For sure, yeah.
There are really several ways to get information. You've got a message log at the top that you can go through as well in more detail. You've got the pop-up messages on the sides. And you've got various filters you can set for all of those as far as what you want popping up and what messages you want to get and what messages you don't.
Okay, is that logged to somewhere where the player can go back and have a textual log to, you know, it's like, how did this happen? And I look back, you know, several hours of gameplay and see, oh, this event was logged.
There is for the high-level stuff. That's certainly a log that's kept. But, you know, for the low-level thing like individual ships and that, often, you know, you don't see stuff. And that's been a constant challenge to give enough feedback to the player, you know. But I think every expansion we've come out with has made a big effort to try and expose more data to the player in a way that's easy to find and see. But it is pretty tough with a game of that scale to actually give appropriate feedback at the right time. We're always learning on that one for sure.
Yeah, it seems like it would be interesting that you could select a ship or a battle group or however you organize them and subscribe to messages from them. Oh. You know, it's like any events from them, just let me know. And almost like a Twitter feed up the side of the screen.
Oh, like you, I want to keep going with that. I want to see what's going on with that exploration ship.
Yeah, we have something like that that we added in for characters. When we added characters,
right? Yeah,
we added an event history for each of them that basically goes back. We felt that was really kind of necessary because of how invested you can get, and so that you can understand what sort of your character accomplished and how that might have fed into how their abilities changed. But I think that's a great idea, you know, in general.
It is a great idea. Concept.
Is there any kind of like a replay that I could go back and say, okay, I want to watch that again and like rewind the game and have it play out?
Only really your save games. That's really all you've got to do that with. Unfortunately, that is a good idea though.
Wouldn't that be like a strain on resources though to keep all that information?
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is you'd have to log everything if you're going to play it back.
Yeah, for very large galaxies, that would be a heck of a lot of information.
Yes,
but you can set it to autosave quite frequently.
That's true. One thing I love about this game is that you're supposed to be an emperor, and as an emperor, you're not supposed to get every little bit of information. That's how I look at it. You're not supposed to get every little scrap of info, unless you want to dig down and be like, instead of being an emperor, you'd be like the master of espionage, or the shipbuilder, or the admiral.
Yeah, that's right. It's however you want to play it. But one aspect of the game that sort of is taken away from you is the private sector. And that's, you know, that's by design, so that a lot of the ships just do their own thing, which, you know, when we're designing the game, the consideration was that a lot of stuff is fairly mundane, fairly boring. And so, although some people may love to delve into that level, basically that's sort of hands off, and all your freighters, all your mining ships, they just go about their business, you know. And that was a conscious decision to get at least half of that micromanagement away from you, so you can concentrate on the rest of the game. But I know, you know, some people like that and some people are not so keen on it, but you know, it's pretty tough to do, to really put that under the player's control too.
I could barely imagine how unwieldy the game would be if you were allowed control of the private sector, because it can be sometimes be a little unwieldy now. Little bit. I mean, it's so massive. I played the original a bit way back, and I have a very short attention span, so I get distracted easily. But I played it for a while. I'm like, oh, my God. And then when I went back to Legends, I skipped Shiktari. How do you say that?
Shakturi, yeah.
Shakturi. Excuse me. I always mess that up. I skipped that when I went right to Legend. I'm like, oh, this seems a lot better. This interface seems a lot cleaner. So yeah, I kind of wanted to ask about that, because a lot of developers and stuff would just go straight to sequels. They'd be like, Distant Worlds 1, Distant Worlds 2, Distant Worlds. But you guys are doing expansions and building upon this foundation of the original game. Was that a plan from the beginning, or did that kind of work out of trying to improve something that you already thought had a lot of potential?
Did you want to have a go at that first, Eric? Or?
Well, sure. I think it's definitely something that we planned on, but we didn't know how far we would go with it. I would say that, you know, the degree of you know, going through Return of the Shakturi and then Legends and now, you know, Shadows is something that evolved over time as far as how full-featured they were, how many expansions there have been, and so on. We definitely knew we wanted to do an expansion, you know, after Distant Worlds. And we definitely looked at the feedback that we had both from the development process and from the tremendous feedback and response we got to the initial release.
Right.
You know, once we had nailed down, you know, the issues, we really wanted to respond to that feedback and make a lot of the improvements that had been requested, as well as things we had had on our back burner that hadn't been able to make it into the initial release timeframe. So there was a tremendous amount of focus on interface and sort of data management in Return of the Shakturi and also in Legends. We've been continuing, like Elliot was saying, to try to keep up with that. As we add more things to each expansion, we try to improve the tools the player has for managing them.
Yeah, I would assume that the expansion UI changes and that are not backported into the earlier versions, right?
No, that's so like right.
Because I'm thinking, if I'm a new player and I want to get just the base game and see if I like it before I jump into that.
So the UI wasn't backported, but we did backport a lot of other improvements. We backported, we did post Easter expansion, we did an update for the previous release that included a lot of the bug fixes, AI improvements, some automation improvements, things like that. But we did not, you know, the rest of it is major changes to the engine that at that point we'd basically be backfitting the whole expansion. So
right, because so, I can't tell you, like, without that side menu on the left-hand side, I'd be lost. Mm. I swear to God. So, like, without that, I'd be like, oh my God, what do I do?
So as a new player, am I at liberty to buy the base game and the most recent expansion, and I can skip the ones in the middle?
No.
Or do I have to get them sequentially?
It would be great if it worked that way, but no, it is sequential because of the nature of how these expansions are done. But I think that the base game, I mean, it's worth noting that the base game, fully updated as it has been, with all the benefit of its initial updates and the post-Return of the Shakturi updates, is really, in my opinion, a very decent place to start. And I think that if you go with the base game plus Return of the Shakturi, you get the bulk of the first wave of interface improvements. So if you're sort of more sensitive to interface and data management, then, you know, that plus the first expansion is an excellent starting point.
Is there a plan from the business perspective to offer a wrapped together version, like it's bundled already, like you buy the base game and that expansion? Because it seems like it's pretty necessary.
But I can't comment on specifics on that. But yeah, that's something we want to do as well.
Oh, that'd be great. Because I got to be honest, I try and sell this game to people all the time. And I'll be honest that is kind of a hurdle that I run into.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is at this point because you've got so many expansions and, you know, people want to jump in at the latest and greatest level. So it becomes almost like, I mean, I've talked with a lot of people on the forum myself and talking to them about the fact that the price point and, you know, all the features, really, you can jump in the middle. You don't have to go all the way to the end, but I think folks really want to, and it becomes more of a hurdle that way. to convince them to do so. So yeah, we have something in the works on that, but I can't comment on timelines or anything.
But I have to say that's very encouraging to hear, because I've had several lengthy discussions with people trying to get them to buy this game, and that is a hurdle. Hmm. You know, they feel that they have to buy all the latest and greatest, and there is an investment. I try to tell people this is an investment in hundreds of hours of gameplay.
Yes, but one of the challenges with games like these is build in a tremendous amount of gameplay, but it's not always as easy to communicate that before you've actually gotten involved in the game.
Exactly.
That's one of the reasons that games like this don't tend to demo very well either, is it's really hard to
I was going
to
ask about a demo, actually.
The depth of the gameplay through a demo. Well, demo-wise, we don't have plans for that right now. Our experience has been that with respect to games that have fairly complex and fairly deep gameplay, that a demo can actually be, in many ways, as much of a hindrance as a benefit. Because people give a demo very little time. I mean, there's some people for whom a demo is naturally suited. But there seem to be a lot more people who will take a look at a demo and they won't invest a significant amount of time into it. They won't really get the idea of the game to the same degree that they would if they either got to watch a friend play it or, you know, for example, if they picked up the initial release and actually gave it a try.
Now, to that end, because I've been watching this guy on YouTube that's doing these sequential Let's Plays to it, right? And he's got hours and hours of just educating people how to play this game. And I'm wondering, coming from Matrix themselves, is that something that you can produce for the entire range of titles that you have? Because all of the war game stuff lends itself to being very detail-oriented. So I would think, to encourage people to put those detailed Let's Plays up is probably, the best sales stuff that you could do.
I agree. We love those Let's Plays, and I have to confess I've spent a fair amount of time watching them. we really try to encourage that pre-release. I mean, we have a program that sends out preview copies specifically to folks who are active in these, Let's Play channels to encourage them to put together Let's Plays of our games. That's an initiative that we've been putting more and more emphasis on over the last couple of years. Definitely. We're very, very pro the Let's Plays. We think that's a great way to learn and experience these games. It's actually better than a typical demo would be. But, Elliot, I wanted to ask, since you passed the ball to me, was there anything you wanted to add to those last few questions?
Nothing really new, but except that, I agree with what's said there. As far as what was sort of added in each expansion, certainly user interface improvements has been the most requested feature that I can think of. And most of our additions have certainly been based on user feedback. You know, we pay a lot of attention to what people say and what they want. And so pretty much our expansions are a distillation of what people ask for, we hope. And so we just progressively work through our big long list of requested features. And as far as, having some sort of roll-up title and that sort of thing, I mean, personally, I agree that's a good idea. And I guess stay tuned for more news on that. But it's we do want more people to, experience the game and enjoy it. And, we anticipate just carrying on with Distant Worlds. Adding new, better, and more things as people ask for them.
Now, we just had a new expansion pack, Shadows, which so far is fantastic. I mean, adding two whole new game modes, basically, is icing, but the real icing, and I have to ask about this, the engine improvement. Now, I don't have the best computer in the world, but it's okay. And Legend ran a little chuggy when you would zoom up and down. It would chug a little bit. This one, smooth as butter.
Mm.
How did that happen?
Well, I mean, the original Distant Worlds and all the way up through to Legends, the graphics were all drawn using Windows GDI, to give you the technical term. And basically that's just unaccelerated software rendering, and it's really slow.
I mean,
we did our best to make it as fast as we could, but we'd hit the limits. And so Shadows uses XNA, which is all hardware accelerated, DirectX sort of thing. So the main display is all rendered with hardware acceleration now. So that's the real difference. And so, yeah, much better performance.
Oh, it's night and day.
Elliot put a lot of effort into that during Shadows development, and it worked out fantastic on our test systems as well. I'm really glad on the feedback we've gotten on that from a lot of people that it really helped them enjoy the game a lot more.
Oh, yeah. I remember the first time I zoomed up and down in Shadow, and even in the beta, I was like, ooh, really? Oh, it's so nice. It's so much smoother.
Since this game has so much going on in it, and in the development of it, I would see where there would be quite an advantage to having a bunch of metadata from all the different clients about how the game was played, you know, and the balancing things and that. So does the game transmit metadata back to you to kind of further development?
No, we don't have anything sort of real time sent back to us. What we've got is just things like crash logs and pretty basic stuff like that.
And we find the best. It's just storage.
Yeah, exactly. So the user's got to send it to us if they want us to see it. Honestly, the best sort of feedback if there's a problem or something they want to explain is a save game from the player. That's, you know, it's not a passive thing. The player has got to send us stuff if they want us to see something.
Okay. I've just noticed with like a lot of the Valve games where they'll come out with a report that will say, oh, well, the trends in players was to make these sort of decisions and do these sorts of things. So we rebalanced AI, you know, and things like that. So I know with their stuff, it must be built like right into the thing that all the games get where it's got a channel back home. Sure. So I just didn't know if you were leveraging that.
Yeah. A lot of those games are designed to be always online. You know, they're designed to play that way. A lot of those are also focused around multiplayer. Our games are perhaps a little more old-fashioned in that sense, in that we think that, you know, based on at least what our customers have told us in our audience, is that folks don't like their applications randomly sending things across the internet without their permission. And they generally want to be able to play offline. They want to be able to buy a boxed copy and, you know that they can play it without internet access and so on. So from a philosophical standpoint, I guess that's one part of it. You know, and the other part is, it's, I think, really well suited to, you know, a multiplayer game, more so than a primarily single player game.
Okay. Yeah. It's just, you know, we're living in the age where everybody's very concerned about what data gets transmitted by what software. So that was a part of that question, but I could also see an advantage to, you know, if you're trying to balance a game out for, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that are playing it, if you like at the end of the game, it's like you won or lost, you know, do you want to send this back home?
Sure.
Something like that. Sure. You know, I don't know if that's of help in developing. What's the development experience been like on this so far? Is there any particular stories from that?
Well, it's, I guess the thing is, the further down the line we go, adding new stuff does take more effort. You know, we're starting with something that was the initial release over 3 years ago now, and so we've grafted a lot of stuff in there, but it does get harder as you go along to add new stuff. And so, but I guess the thing is, the feedback we've got, we're just following basically what people want to see, and so we add stuff in that they ask for.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have, development-wise, we have a good group of internal testers as well, that have provided us with feedback both from the, you know, different parts of the community. I mean, we've got folks there who play the game in different ways and use the game in different ways. So they give us some feedback while we're in development. Elliot and I chat all the time and just sort of bounce things around. There's a tremendous amount of attention paid to community feedback. And every now and then we just get ideas that come out of nowhere that we decide are would be really fun or really interesting to add in, and so we give it a try. I mean, the like in Shadows, you know, the game modes that you mentioned, you know, the idea to play as a pirate, the idea to do pre-warp, you know, those were based both on community feedback and on our own wish lists of where we wanted to see Distant Worlds go, what we wanted to explore as far as what the design could do.
I got to say, I'm sorry, I just wanted to say the pre-warp idea was fantastic because I know while you were having the sale, I did convince at least a few people to buy the game, and they said that the pre-warp era really helped them grasp the game because it's a much tighter focus.
Yeah, for sure. You constrict it to your own system and there's a lot less to worry about. Yeah, I've seen comments like that too.
We've been discussing actually doing sort of an introductory pre-warp mode as one of the built-in options, you know, based on that feedback. Because I think that because of the fact that it was combined in development with the Age of Shadows, which is a very difficult time period to play in the Distant Worlds storyline, it's one where, you know, these non-planetary empires that are, you know, the remnants of the old civilizations and fleets that devolved into these, you know, different types of quote-unquote pirates, they're basically ruling space, and they're making it really hard for you to get out there. We looked at that. We didn't really, I think, realize how much the pre-warp gameplay also at the same time simplified things for new players. So based on that feedback, we've been talking about what we could do to give new players a pre-warp introduction that wasn't quite as scary in terms of
simply just trying to solve. Not so complex. Yeah.
No, that'd be a good, like,
stay tuned on that.
That'd be a good, like, extra tutorial, you know, or another tutorial level. That'd be fantastic. So I wanted to ask about the AI, because this game is insanely AI dependent. And I've just sat there and watched the AI do amazing things. I've watched them do stupid things. I've watched them do funny things. It's amazing the variety of things that can happen in a game based on the AI. So how was the AI created? Is there one AI that handles everything? Are there different, like, little miniature AIs for each empire and each ship? How does the AI work in the game?
Well, it's really very case by case. It's, you know, depending on what's happening. It's influenced by things like the race the players playing as, and as you probably appreciate, each empire in the game with its own race basically uses the same kind of AI with tweaks for each race. And so, if you as the player turn on all automation, you're effectively handing it over to the AI to play. And depending on which areas you turn it on or off, the automation. So that's sort of basically how it works. But it's very much fine tuning as you go. The thing about Distant Worlds being such a big open game where we try not to limit the possibilities, we try to leave everything as open as possible. Very unpredictable things can happen. So to cater for all that is difficult. But we just try and make things as simple as we can, while catering for all the edge cases that you come up with. You know, like, how does a ship decide when to attack an enemy, and how far to go, and when should it refuel? All those sorts of questions there's endless variations and inputs that can make that decision. And things are always a lot more complicated than you might think at first. So we've had a lot of fun trying to develop that, you know, as we've gone through all the expansions. And I think we've done a huge amount of work, especially in Legends and Shadows, under the covers to try and make that better. Especially in Shadows, we found we had to make a lot of improvements to the AI, like the civilian economy, how the freighters work, all that sort of thing, because with the pre-warp empires confined to their home system, we found that the Legends AI didn't really cut it as far as distributing resources and that sort of thing. So as one example, we had to really make a lot of improvements there in Shadows so that even in the pre-warp, that stuff all functions.
And I think probably, you know, next to interface, AI has been the second biggest area of focus, which doesn't always, you know, come out as a big feature point, because the AI obviously has been there from the start, but it's taken a lot of time on the development side. I mean, Elliot is one of the most hardworking developers you'll probably ever meet, and he's really done a good job, you know, improving that and keeping pace, because almost every time we add features or change something gameplay-wise, the AI has to be able to adapt to it. And so everything we do where we change the game, there's always an additional AI task list there to make sure it can utilize it fully.
Well, it looks like the AI is actually playing the game by the same rules that you are, as opposed to being, you know, the AI fakes it and tries to look natural.
That's it. I mean, the AI does operate the same way as the player's automation does. Yeah, so it's following the same rules. The only changes we've made in Shadows with new difficulty settings now gives some unfair advantages to the AI if you tweak up the difficulty. But it's still playing by the same rules. It just has a few, you know, advantages and resources and so forth. So, yeah,
it's bonuses, just in terms of what how many resources an incoming gets, but it still plays by the same rules. It's not a cheating AI or a smoke and mirrors AI.
Yeah. Can you give me an idea of, because I've never coded an AI, but I sit and try to think of, like, how would I solve this problem even on a flowchart of making decisions? So what happens with, let's say, a given faction? Do they have sort of an emperor AI that decides this is what my focus is and how I'm going to interact foreign policy-wise, and then it dictates to sub-AI routines that do the individual jobs?
Well, probably a good way to understand Distant Worlds AI is to look at the automation settings and the options screen. And basically, each area there pretty much corresponds to an area of the AI. So there isn't really a master AI as such. It's more of a matter in each area, like colonization or research or what have you. The decisions that are made, that's where the AI plugs into that area. And those things are influenced by your empire policy as well. In the empire policy screen, you can fine-tune how the AI works. And you can say, you know, give priority to this or that. And a lot of it is simply making prioritized lists of items that you then work off. For example, you know, where are your new colonies going to be, or where are you going to do some mining next, or who do you dislike the most in diplomacy to go and attack next. So it's a lot of it is that, prioritizing things and working things out based on how far away they are from you, distance-wise, and all sorts of factors like that that give different weightings to decide what to do next in any given area.
So do different racial AIs have different, you know, it's like their values are in perhaps a different order in the list?
Yeah, that's basically it. They prioritize things differently based on their personality and values, for sure.
Okay, now do some races, are the personalities of the AI influenced by what race the AI is, or is it just any personality could land on any race randomly?
No. Each race has its defined personality. So, you know, the mod is can alter those sort of things in the race text files, and they can give them different priorities. But it's probably the races and the empire policy. Those two interact together to give the tweaking to the AI for each empire.
Yeah, because it's pretty fascinating.
Okay, makes sense.
Kinda. I'm no programmer, so kinda. But it's just fascinating to how it all works together. Now, one thing I wanted to ask about this game. Excuse me. I have not had a game where exploration and discovery has been as much fun as Distant Worlds since maybe Starflight, if you guys played that one back in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
The thing I love most about Distant Worlds is how it's kind of an ant farm in its own way. And like a lot of space games, you have your solar systems and you have your colonies. And in between those, you may have a black hole or you may have a nebula. But here you have smugglers running around. You have space monsters running around. I mean, there's all these different facets going on in the systems, in between the systems. You know, there's all the space landscape. How does that all come together? Are these all different disparate systems? I mean, how does the universe get populated to such an extent that it's just such a joy to discover and explore it? That's a weird question, but
I think I know where you're going with that. That's something personally I really like myself, that aspect of the game, the exploration.
Oh, yeah.
And I think part of it is you've got to have a big big galaxy to start with. You've got to have a lot of space to do that in. And so that was a design decision way back. But what gets put into those spaces to discover is something we've just gradually added to based on user feedback. And but I mean, all those things, they have their own rules, and they have their own AI and follow their own sort of logic. But we've just, any ideas people have had, we've tried our best to try and accommodate them and plug them into the game. You know, I think the secret of, to me, games that are fun are ones that have a real sense of adventure and discovery. And it's when you find something new and unexpected, that's when that happens. And so I see those as really valuable parts of the game, and we just try and put as much of that in as we can. And I think each expansion has sort of added new bits to that as well, some major and some minor. We constantly want to put those things in there.
Yeah, like, I don't think before – was there a ship graveyard before Shadows? Because I don't remember seeing that, for example.
some of those things have been in there from the start, but I think in the original Distant Worlds, they were quite hard to discover, and we didn't really promote them that much. But yes, certainly Shakturi and Legends, they started to expose those a lot more.
Yeah, with each of the storylines, we added more special events. When we expanded on the races, we added, you know, race events and things like that. And in almost all those cases, we added extra little bits and pieces around the galaxy that were related to those things. So, I mean, I agree with you. Starflight, I think, is a good analogy. It is really fun to explore. It's one of my favorite parts of the game as well. And it's something that was in there, you know, from the start, as far as all those little interesting parts of the original storyline and how they interact with your exploration ships. And you can stumble on them either by design in terms of following the clues that lead you here and there, or you can stumble on them purely by accident because they're not showing up only when, you know, a part of the storyline is triggered. They're there all along. It's just such a huge galaxy that it's hard to stumble on them without having some of those clues, unless you do a really, really good job exploring. Part of the joy is finding those. I mean, I know we had one guy who played the original game and talked about the fact that this was just by chance, the way the galaxy was generated, that he started his game and he actually had a ship graveyard and including one of the planet destroyers in his home system.
Oh, God.
That was a very interesting game.
Oh, no. Oh, God, that'd be horrible.
Maybe not quite by design, but anyway.
Oh, I didn't tell you about that one.
Oh, man, that'd be a terrible starting system to start with. That would be terrible. Now, I wanted to ask you one thing that I love about 2D games, which is one thing I love about 2D games like this is how people can change the artwork and stuff like that to put different ships in there. Like, there's a Star Trek mod for this, and there's other mods. Like, I think there's a Mass Effect mod. Was modding in the cards from the beginning, or was that added later? Because that really is, I'm sorry, that's just really given the game even more legs than it already has.
Oh, definitely. And we did want to put that in there right from the start. So I think when we released initial Distant Worlds, we actually had the modding guide out before the game. So we really wanted to push that. And I know people have made amazing efforts in there. In fact, some of the modders have ended up contributing to the expansions, you know, that so
really?
Some really talented people in there. That's really great to see. But, you know, that is a bonus, I guess, of having, as you say, a 2D game. It's relatively easy to make artwork and to plug it in. So each expansion, we've tried to extend the modding to add, you know, enable more things to be changed. And I'm sure we're going to keep on doing that.
Well, I think I read somewhere, Eric, maybe you said this, that the next expansion is going to focus on modding. Is that correct?
That is true. And to any modders listening, Elliot is working on the modding guide for Shadows. It's coming. It's coming. Yeah, the next one is modder-focused. We really wanted to do more for the modding community, but we wanted to also hit some of these really important things we wanted to do for Shadows. So we thought the best way to make sure that modding, a lot of the, you know, long-term modders' big wish items, you know, were looked at and addressed, was to have a modder-focused expansion. So that's next in line.
And was that? I'm guessing that's probably next year.
I can't really say yet.
Of course.
I'll say that we're working on getting it out ASAP. I don't think the development on that is going to be as long as Shadows, which was our longest expansion by far, development-wise.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that because it added the Shadows game mode and the Pirate game mode?
Yeah, they added a lot of work for sure. Probably more than we anticipated.
They broke a lot of things, put it that way. We had to redesign and re-engineer a lot of things to make sure all that worked as intended. It was all worth it in the end, but it was definitely a bit more than we initially realized it would be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are still actually in the process of nailing down exactly what the final list of what will be in the modder expansion will be. So I can't really give out much info on that except to say that it is next in line and we've started, you know, the process of nailing that down. We'll get it out as soon as we can.
And I'm sure people are going to want it now because I know I do, even though I'm not a modder. I'm sure it'll add some fun stuff anyway. But
yeah, I wish we could do these one a month, but I think we can't.
Oh my God!
Had a clone Elliot yet? He's resisting.
Yeah, I think I just spanked him hearing that. But, yeah.
make it like a Madden thing. Make it annual. Just keep doing that. Distant Worlds 2014. Distant Worlds 2014.
If not for Shadows, we would have made that. That one kind of blew through the schedule, but in the others, we were pretty well on track.
Now I got to ask about the piracy in Shadows because. I've never played a pirate. We did a podcast talking about piracy a while back, and neither of us really play pirates very often. But so when I tried being a pirate in this, I wasn't very good at it, because I'm just too nice. I'm just not aggressive enough. But what was the process of creating the piracy gameplay? Because it's so different than the empire based gameplay. How did that all come about?
Well, there were some obvious things that pirates do that made it pretty simple to start with. You know, they're going to be capturing stuff, and that was a new feature in Shadows, of course, too. Capturing and boarding ships and bases.
I love that, and I hate that. I love it when I capture something, and I love when I do it, and I hate when it's done to me.
Indeed,
it is terrible.
but I mean, beyond that, it was just a matter of. Making them viable, I guess, adding more. It's a very active form of play style. It's quite different from normal Empire building.
Yeah, it's much more hands-on. Even with the AI doing what it's doing, it's much more hands-on and seeking out targets to raid and seeking out, you know, ships to and bases to raid and all that stuff. It's so much more hands-on than I was even prepared for.
Yeah, well, I mean, for some people that may not be their style, and that's fine. But even in that case, you're still benefiting from, on the other side of the coin, when you're playing as a normal empire, you're getting much more aggressive pirates too. So it's sort of, you know, it's a benefit either way, even if you don't play that as a pirate. But I mean, basically what we found when we're testing, especially the pre-warp game, was that to get the balance right between a normal empire and pirates and both being survivable was quite a challenge. So we had to do quite a bit of tuning to get the pirate income level just right, to give them enough sources of income so there's enough variety within the pirate play style. You can play a pirate lots of different ways, you know, what sort of things do you want to do, and still have the normal empires not getting overwhelmed by the pirates. Hopefully we've sort of got that right, but yeah, that was quite a challenge to get that balance.
I think you did a good job, because with the new ground attack stuff especially, like, you can't – colonies just won't roll over for you, because if they do, you'll just take everything they have and there'll be nothing left to take, and then you'll be screwed because they won't produce anything.
You know. I mean, to speak to that too, I think what really – I found really interesting about doing the pirates – is the fact that not only does it give you this more active play style, but it also gives you a little bit more intimate play style. You're focusing on a smaller scale most of the time with pirates.
Yeah, you have to.
Until you break out, until you really succeed as a pirate empire and make that transition to where you've also got some planets that you actually own, you know, you're usually working with fewer ships. You're usually focusing on fewer things at a time than when you're playing an empire, a planetary empire, that is. And I also like the fact that you can, as with the planetary empires and the different races and governments, you can also play very different types of pirates. They are all fairly active play styles. Right. But you don't have to be, you know, when we use the word pirate in Distant Worlds, it also means, it can mean very different things from the classic, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean type of situation. Because what these guys really are is space-based survivors, that they've just found a way to exist without actually living on a planet. And so some of them are out there, you know, they're really not producing, they're just taking. Others can put themselves in positions, you know, as traders, or just focus on eventually owning a planet, transitioning to becoming more of a planetary playstyle. And it's all out there. So you don't have to be a big bad guy, but you can. You know, you can play as something like the guys from Firefly and just basically go and create chaos and kill things, or you can basically play as a peaceful trade empire of a different kind, just one that has the challenge of starting without a planet. So I think it really turned a lot of things in Distant Worlds sort of on their heads. And I think whether you play as a pirate or as a planetary empire, you do get the benefit of that. The pirates have a real economy now.
Yeah, exactly.
Previously they didn't. Previously, and I understood, you know, for some people, pirates were a negative before Shadows because they were really there more as just another sort of almost annoying balance event for the empires. But
so when you play as
Shadows,
storyline,
and they have things that you really, as a planetary empire, you understand both what they benefit from and how to dismantle them. Sorry, go ahead.
Whenever you start out as a pirate, what do you have? Because do you have like a space station or like a pirate base somewhere that's removed from a planet?
That's it. You start off with a base and a few ships. And depending on the style you've selected, the style of pirate, that sort of determines the composition of your ships, how many of each type and so forth, military and freighters. But most the different play styles have a different focus of types of income that they're particularly good at. You know, some are natural smugglers, some are more raiders and that sort of thing. So you're better off playing to your strengths of the selected play style and doing whatever you're good at.
Okay, so are pirates unique in that they can build bases that are not tied to a planet?
That's true. They're the only ones who can build spaceports at a place that's not a colony. So they do have a few unique factors like that. They also have a slightly different balance in their ship maintenance costs and that sort of thing too to make them viable. But yeah, they really are a space-based type of faction, quite unique and different from a normal empire.
So do they participate in the political things that go on between the other factions, or do they have to reach a certain level before they're brought into that?
Their diplomacy is a lot simpler. They basically have protection arrangements where you can decide to pay off a pirate and they won't attack your assets. They don't really go much beyond that. Pirates are fairly simple on the diplomacy side.
But they do have previously it was all agreement-based. Now they do actually have, you know, a valuation that they give you and that, you know, you give them in terms of the diplomacy on how much they trust you, how long they've dealt with you, and that can also affect their behavior towards you. I mean, if you get a pirate faction with the proper play style and you have a long-term agreement with them, they can actually become very useful to you in terms of how much they're actually willing to commit to help protect your systems and, you know, basically their relationship with you and the investment that you represent to them.
Yeah, all based on your past actions and dealings with each other. Yeah, so they can like you or hate you.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen them hate me. And that's not as much fun as them liking me.
How is the diplomacy decided as far as how much they like you, how much they hate you? Is it a like you have a valued list of if I do this, it will give me so many points, positive or negative, in the scale?
There's some items like that. You know, obviously, if you attack someone's ships or capture them or whatever, there's a negative impact related to whatever was captured. But there's other things too, like if you simply have a protection agreement for a long time, that sort of builds trust over time. So there's various types of things that can influence the relationship.
And if you're on the diplomacy screen, I mean, you see those factors broken out for you. So you basically can see the overall relationship and what are the different things that contribute to that modifier.
Right. Yeah, I do like how kind of transparent that is. Like, oh, they hate me because I tried to attack the same colony they did. Yeah. That makes sense. That's pretty clear.
And that's pretty much how the diplomacy works between the normal empires too. You know, those sort of factors, and we break them out. Yeah.
No, there's just so much good stuff going on in there. So I got to ask, is the next expansion the last expansion before a sequel? Maybe?
What does Eric have to say about that?
You're pushing hard, Brian.
I'm not trying to be rude or anything. I'm a fanboy.
I didn't mean to be rude in return. I think it's premature to answer that. I will say this, we're planning on a sequel. But I don't think anybody really knows exactly when and how
to. Oh, no, I'm not expecting it tomorrow or even next year. I just wanted to know if one was, like, even planned. That's all I wanted to know. Because I'm just excited about the prospect.
We'd like to do a sequel someday. I think our focus for the near future is going to be on the next expansion, and we'll see where things take us. But I think certainly a sequel is something that all of us want to do at some point.
That's awesome, because yeah, there's so much more I think that can be done with this.
Well, I think we are hitting the point now in the life cycle of Distant Worlds as it stands, where we're starting to face technical limitations with the existing engine and so forth. So certainly a fresh start and a proper sequel is the way to solve that. So I think you're going to have some confidence that's where we're heading. Yeah.
That's very exciting because, again, love this game so much. Anyway.
So are there any particular developing lessons that this game's taught you along the arc?
I guess, you know, you want to cram in as much as possible into the game. It's always just a constant trade-off between what users want to put into the game, you know, the requests for new features, versus keeping everything understandable, simple enough to follow, and giving enough feedback to users. Probably that's the single biggest thing I think I've learned, is that you can never give too much user feedback. You know, having a good user interface, messages, all sorts of things like that. You can't assume people understand things because you do, that's for sure. So I think that's the single biggest thing. And I think, you know, every expansion we've just been adding more feedback as we can. So you can never have too much.
No, and I got to say, the UI just seems to get better. I love the winning condition screen? That might be my favorite screen.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it breaks out all the factors there, right?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, there are other, I wish other space games had had that kind of detail. I guess my last question is, if there's someone else out there listening to this who wants to make their own massive 4X space game, and there are a lot of them in the works right now. I don't know if you guys have been paying attention, but I can think of at least 4 or 5 right off the top of my head that are in the works. These things are coming out of the woodwork, which is great. Not knocking it. But would you have any advice for anyone who's maybe getting started in making their own space 4X, or any 4X even, but especially a space 4X?
I guess it's always bigger than you think. There's a lot of work to it, obviously. And I guess the thing is being willing to be flexible and listen to all the feedback you get, positive and negative, and being willing to adapt to that feedback. It's going to, you know, the more, and of course, the more you listen, the more work it's going to create for you too. But in the long run, I think that's the way to go, is be willing to modify your plan based on your feedback. Don't be rigidly glued to your original vision. But it's going to take a lot of hard work. That's all I'd say too.
From my experience with all the games we've done, you know, creating a game is probably about the closest I've come as a man to giving birth.
You create games too? I don't know what your
I work on a lot of games. I don't create in the sense that that I program them, but I work together with a lot of developers. And I'm saying both from the what I see the developers going through and from our side as a publisher, it's definitely, you know, as Elliot said, it's harder than you think. But I think if you're motivated by doing what you're really loving to do, if you're making the game that you would like to play, then I think you'll find the energy and the passion to get through that. And you know, as Elliot said, adapt and overcome. You're gonna get days when people give you really positive feedback that lifts you up, and you're gonna get days when people tell you, you know, really negative feedback, and you have to rewrite things and redesign things. But it all makes for a better game as long as you're willing to listen.
Right. Oh, and that just led to another question. Did you guys try Star Drive at all?
I haven't. I know. I saw that. It looks very nice. I haven't tried it.
I have played it.
It kind of strikes me as, and I'm not trying to knock it, well, I kind of am at the same time, but it's kind of strikes me as trying to be Distant Worlds a little bit.
Yeah, it's almost like, hey, we're going to be Distant Worlds light.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We didn't quite make it yet.
No.
But they're in what? Are they officially released, or are they still like a beta?
No, they're early officially access? Released, but they shouldn't have been.
Yeah, they shouldn't have done that.
Shouldn't have done that.
It's got potential. It's just not there yet.
Yeah. I just wondered.
I can't speak to the specifics of the game because I haven't played it, but I have to say it is really hard to know when you're ready to release, to be honest. And so I don't knock anyone for making the effort there, but it's you know, if you're in that situation, you just have to keep listening to feedback and plugging away at it, you know. And if you do that, you'll improve it.
Yeah, and I think the thing I'll add is that, you know, as Elliot said, you know, he started working on this game because it was the game he wanted to play.
Right.
That's what we're about at Matrix in general, is we're trying to make the games that we like to play. So I'm happy in general when I get to play more of the types of games that I like to play in the free time I have. So
which doesn't
kudos to anybody who puts in the effort to put their vision and put their, you know, creativity into a game and get it out there. I wish them the best.
And it doesn't look like you have a lot of free time if your activity on the forum is any indication. Because, my God, you are a busy fella.
It keeps me busy. It does keep me busy. But I do have time. I do have some free time. You know, family and gaming are my two main hobbies.
How long have you been at Matrix?
We're going back a long time now. We founded Matrix back in 99.
Oh, my God.
I was one of the original five that founded it.
Did you guys know each other? What's the back history of Matrix? Was it like five guys that knew each other and decided to do that? Or
that's actually a really long story. But let me give you the very abbreviated version, which is that we did know each other before we founded Matrix. We had worked together to various degrees. Some of us had done something called the Gamers Net before that, which at one point was the most popular.
That sounds really familiar.
Site on the internet for these types of.
Yeah, that sounds really familiar.
Strategy games, and we sold that during the .com craze, and used the funds from that to start a game company. Because what we really were doing on the side was we were working on games, and back then I was actually doing some programming too. Though I've long since ceased to do that. And so we made a combination of working with, at that point, with external developers, and we had some internal projects as well, and that has continued to this day. And, you know, it really just comes back down to we saw a point in time where there weren't as many of the games that we liked on the market as we wanted to see. Gaming was going in a different direction, and we wanted to make sure that those kinds of games were still being made.
Well, since you've been there since the beginning, I want to deviate a moment, if you'll allow me, and ask about another game. Star Shatter.
Yeah, great game.
What happened there? It seemed to just implode at one point. Like, it just, development seemed to stop and everything. And it was very confusing at the time. So I was wondering if you could shed any light on that.
Well, okay. I mean, we're going, this is going a pretty far ways back.
Yeah, like 2004, yeah, I think.
But you know, some of this is really just going to be from the publisher perspective. I mean, I'm sure there's another, you know, whole separate story there from the developer perspective. But one of the things that's pretty typical for these types of games is that they have a relatively small development team. You know, you're talking usually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people. Something like that are actually developing the games. So anytime that you have a small development team, what happens, you know, in the personal life of the developer is also has a big influence. My recollection is John DiCamillo, who developed the game, who was a fantastic guy.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Really good programmer. He was also going through some changes in his life, I think, as far as his family expanding and things like that, and he had, you know, fundamentally, he made the game he wanted to make, and he had some changing priorities. It was, I think, a new job came along, and I think his family expanded, and I think both of those combined to put the game on the back burner for him, which is something that I personally, you know, regret as well. I mean, I think that it would have been great if that came and also come out a little bit later. That was one of our first, if not our first, sci-fi game.
I think so. I think I remember that.
At that point in time, I think our sci-fi audience was not as well established as it is now, too. We've brought that game to retail at the time. You know, at that point, when that was originally released, there were, you know, our store was not as big. The other distribution channels were not available. And so we brought that one to retail. It had a big retail release and so on. So it got a lot of attention. It got a lot of reviews. It was a very good game. I always found it to be a very interesting mix of sort of a starship battle simulator and Wing Commander. In the sense that you start out as a fighter pilot and work your way up.
It's very unique still.
So, you know, maybe someday we'll be able to do something else with that. I don't know. Right now, I haven't heard anything as far as anything happening with that. But that's definitely a game that I would love to, at some point, see, you know, not just fade away.
Well, it did just go open source, I think, last year.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about that, since we're going down that road. You guys, from the publisher perspective, when you have a third-party developer that you're working with, and they decide, okay, this is the end of the life cycle of this product, I'm going to turn it out open source. Is there any provisions that need to be in that with the publisher ahead of time that leaves the developer with the possibility of that, where they can just say, okay, my game's abandonware now?
It all depends on the contract. But in general, we're really big proponents of, you know, developers having control over the intellectual property of their own game. So that's generally something that, I mean, we started out, it's worth noting, we started out, our first release was basically, we took a game that was really popular game called Steel Panthers, and we and we managed to secure the rights to that. It was one of the games that had been part of SSI, and it was very popular. But it had, you know, as part of SSI being bought and going through several acquisitions, it had basically become orphaned and was not something that was of any value to its current owner. We managed to secure the rights to that, and we then made the code available to several development teams, including our own, in order to secure a future for that game. And we released it for free. And then we proceeded to do what we called these mega campaign expansions that were a separate system with code that we had done ourselves that provided a really involved and immersive, you know, historical campaign that you could play and that would add on to the game. But that was, you know, that was where we started. So, you know, we're certainly comfortable with that idea, and we're really, one of our main things is we really try to take care of our developers. We really try to do publishing in an old-fashioned way, in the sense that we really work with them. We really try to care for them and make sure that they're, that everything we could possibly do for them, you know, we try to do.
So does Matrix, is your only storefront through matrixgames.com, or do you occasionally put titles through other distributors like Deser or Steam or anything like that, or is that too much overhead to get the exposure?
It's not really an overhead issue. We're the biggest publisher of these types of games. So we have done experimentation through some other channels in the past. So we very much do it on a case-by-case basis because we have a tremendous amount of data on how these games sell, who the audience is, what they want, and basically how to maximize the revenue and the profit for us and our developers with these types of games, which is ultimately the point of a business. We want to make the games we want to make, but we also want to make sure our developers can keep making those games, and we can keep making those games that we're all successful. So what we do, and we had actually a lot of discussions about this with our community as well. You know, there have been a lot of questions along these lines over the years. And so what we do is very, very much try to tailor an approach for each individual game of what we think will make it the most successful for that game and for that developer. And so we're not... we're not anti using the other channels, but we'll only use them if we think that it's going to lead to the best possible success for a game. We've taken many games to retail. We've had games that are pretty much on every channel out there. And we've got games across multiple platforms, you know, so PC, PlayStation, Xbox, iPad, you know, what have you. It's just on a very much a case-by-case basis for the developer for the game.
Okay. That's a lot of good questions. We should probably wrap this thing up. it's late for you guys.
I think Elliot's just getting started.
Oh,
what? Yeah. Middle of the day.
Just kidding, Elliot.
what time is it where you are right now, Elliot?
It's not even 3 o'clock yet in the afternoon.
It's almost 8 o'clock here on the West Coast. So
yeah, it's almost 11 here on the East Coast. So
what we're doing is we're delaying the next expansion.
Yeah.
So we have to let him get back.
We gotta let you guys. Around. Yeah, we've already delayed you about an hour. We got to stop now. So you can get on.
But I'll mention that if anybody wants to see us in person and see our games and have them demoed or just stop by and say hi, we're going to be at Historicon next week in Fredericksburg, Virginia.
And I'm going to be there too. Yay!
You'll be there too. Indeed. I look forward to meeting you in person.
I know. I'm very excited about that. This is the first time I've done like a big gaming thing in a long time. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, and it's kind of unique that Brian and I have been doing this show. We've never met each other. So that's our opportunity is he's going to be a few hours from my place, so I'm going to drive up.
That'll
be a fun.
I look forward to meeting you too, then, Jim.
Yeah, we're going to try to do something at the show. That'll be really fun. But
be happy to get you a personal demo of Distant Worlds.
There you go.
Is Historicon an event that Matrix is a sponsor of, or are you just an attendee?
We've gone to a lot of shows over the years. This is our first time doing a big presence at Historicon, actually. We've done a lot of Origins, Gen Cons, World Board Game Championships, Spiel, in essence, Salute in the UK. But previously, we've only done a few small booths at Historicon. So we're going all out this year for the first time, and we'll see how it goes. We're having a big booth as well as a press event there this year. So it's pretty much a full-court press. I think if it goes well this year, then we'll be more involved in the future. We'll be making that part of our standard convention circuit.
Yeah, I looked at some pictures of Historicon from 2012, and I would have to say that those people have your target audience written all over them.
I think that's true.
I'm just trying to figure out how to make BattleTech passes historical, so that I can show up with my.
There
stuff.
Was that one so. Civil War multiplayer game that had like these steampunk mechs in it. Remember that? Apparently it was released way too early and no one played it.
Did you ever play Titans of Steel, Jim?
Remember. That was released for free a while back, wasn't it?
Yeah, we published that one. It's available for free on our site.
It's kind of Mech Warrior-esque. It's kind of like it's.
I'm remembering something from like back in the Amiga days, and it was the developer that did it. I can't
BattleTech,
think of their name.
The Clan, the BattleTech, the first BattleTech game.
No, it was like I'll have to look it up. I'll just give it to you, and you can put it in the show notes. But it was some guys, and I met him at E3, and I just for the life of me, he said that, and I remembered something else. So never mind.
Well, let's wrap this up, guys. I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us to talk about this amazing, I don't know if you'd call it a game series, but at least game. I want to thank you so much for explaining more about how it works, how Matrix works too, because I'm sure people want to know about that. And I'm looking forward to meeting you next week, Eric. That's exciting.
Thanks for having us, Brian.
Oh,
it was a pleasure.
I hope to bring you back around the time the next one gets released.
Is Matrix headquartered in Virginia, or where are you guys located?
New Hampshire,
centrally?
I think. New Hampshire, Vermont, right?
Our production office is in Vermont, which is where I'm located. So that's where I go to work every day, where we have basically all the folks in charge of production, and in my case, in product development, and some support. And we also have an office in, since we're... It's the Slytherin group now, really. So it's Slytherin and Matrix and Aegon.
Right.
At this point, so we've also got a UK office. We've also got some accounting folks in Colorado. We've got an Italy office, which is mainly the marketing office.
Huh.
That pretty much covers the main location.
That explains the name of the fellow who's putting my Historicon trip together.
Like, yeah, Marco?
Marco or Filippo?
Filippo.
Yeah, one of those guys. That explains that. That's funny. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, guys and folks. Stay tuned next week. We're going to have more fun stuff. Thank you, as always, for listening. Don't forget, you can contact us at hail@spacegamejunkie.com, where you can leave your comments below. And thank you again so much for listening, and have a great night.
Let's have some music in here, Boiler.
Sure thing.
Down, but I see the only one. Trying to think I'm over you. I find I'm just begun. The years move faster than the days. There's no warmth in the light. And how I miss those desert skies. You're